First of all, here it is. Super Trainee, sixth edition. Why should coaches read this book? Because we've been talking about this for a while. Coaches need to get it. I know why. I have my thoughts. I want you to speak about it because you're the expert.
Okay. So you want to go like from the beginning of the book?
Let's start high level of like, hey, this is why we need to, this is why the strength and conditioning industry needs to read this book. Go on a tangent. You don't have to dive into anything. And then anybody that's listening right now, you understand that we have broken the book up into 15 page readings. And then after you just give the high level of like, hey, this is why the book needs to be read. We won't do this again, but this is episode one.
Yeah.
And then after you talk about like the bastardization of what's happening in the field and why people are stealing ideas and claiming it to be their own. And then after that, that's when we can dive into like, okay, pages one through 15, your biggest takeaways and anything that you want to dive in.
Got it. Okay. You ready?
I am.
Let's do it.
So pilot, like why do we need to read this?
So, you know, I think that the thing about Super Training and remember that this is the sixth edition. It was first printed in 1993. Which I got, I think, in 1994, right when it had come out in the United States, because it started being published at Witwatersrand in South Africa when Mosif was there. Yuri was still living in Moscow at the time. So the book was being printed primarily there. When Mel moved over here in the late 90s, probably like 96, 97-ish, maybe slightly earlier, he started printing it in the United States. I already had a copy. And, you know, it was the establishment of, you know, of all of the principles of sports training that had been established or perfected in the Soviet Union. So most of the ideas or concepts that we recognize in sports training, the science of, originated there, right? So they were being articulated and kind of fleshed out in Super Training, because up until that point in 93, you really didn't have a text that was comprehensive that looked at all of the principles of training, right? Like Dr. Yeses had been translating the journals from 1964 to 1993 in the Soviet sports reviews. So you got you know, that information in journal form. You got good articles. You know, there wasn't a ton of other information, though, I would say, like in the 70s and 80s, even into the early 90s, there wasn't a ton of information in that regard. So this kind of just set the principles. This kind of like, here's the overarching ideas. So I think what this does, one thing that Super Training does, It lets you see the origin of real concepts, not fake concepts. So there's a lot of people in the United States now who believe, you know, someone. I'll give you an example, because I just had this earlier in the week. I've had a girl shadowing me. She actually, you're the one that referred her to me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Hannah. Yep. And so she's been shadowing me for about, I don't know, quite a few months now, since probably late fall. And, well, actually, she came to me in the summer, too. So she says, okay, can you look at this? I've seen this on Instagram. She'll send me different things. And she goes, what is this? So plyometrics is one of them. She said they're all talking about plyometrics. And they say, okay, these are your plyometrics, your jumps, your depth jump. Your med ball throws, all these are all plyometrics, right? And I'm like, well, you know, the term's being bastardized. Those are not plyometrics according to Yuri. And in Super Training, he tells you, I don't like being called the father of plyometrics because you've bastardized the term. And and the original term was shock method to begin with. Yep. Plyometrics was something that had been coined by Fred Wilt at Purdue. He was a track coach. He used that term and it kind of stuck. But my point is that a lot of different types of jumps get classified or just put into this big pile of jumps, and they call them all plyos. But the reality is there's a big difference between different types of jumps. And then obviously then there's a succession and a progression, right? You wouldn't know that if you read most of what you see online, right? So Super Training is a book that kind of sets that, at least kind of gives you some parameters, right? It establishes where did that come from, what was the evolution thereof, and his last book that he did before he passed, you know, he wrote the book Shock Method, and then that elucidated it even further, right? But the point is that that was key. And one other thing that I thought was key, I'll make this one other little quick comment. Natalia Vershansky, I remember when she came over here, it's been over a decade now, she did talk on the Shock Method. She said she had looked at 300 YouTube clips on the depth jumper plyos, and only one was correct out of 300. So that, what is that? It's 0.03%, 0.3%. So point being is that then that obviously there's a lot of misinformation, right? So one of the things about super training, and this is in the first 15 pages, but I think it's an interesting point, is the different types of strength. And I think this was something that was not elucidated previously. Because even like when you have conversations with coaches or, you know, different people in the field, strength is used as this term, and everybody thinks they, you know, like, okay, I know what you mean, right? And the way that strength gets developed, though, is different. Like speed strength is developed differently. Maximal strength, you know, is a different output. And then even in the super training book, he talks about how Zatsiorsky, you know, talked about the, I don't know what the term was, the absolute max. I got to look at it here real quick.
Absolute max and competitive.
Yes. And the training maximum, and then the maximum, what is that term he used? It was absolute strength, which is involuntary. So that's where, you know, it could be stimulated by E-stim. That would take it up to its absolute capacity. And the other one, is different. And then you have a training maximum, which is something that's not going to be, you know, not something that you could do relatively normally. You know, and then we get to a competition that's a different story, that's going to be under a different set of circumstances and whatnot. So I think that that's important. And I think Brian Mann has done a nice job of kind of elucidating that. So did Antonio of elucidating the ideas of different types of strength on that scale when you talk about velocity, if you will, power development. I think that the thing about this book is there's a lot of information in there that you didn't know. Very useful information that you had not heard about. So it wasn't like it was a new addition to the library. It established the library, in my opinion, academic texts on the field that also could be read by, you know, a coach, or professor, researcher, and even the athlete. You know, if you really try hard, you can read through it. It's hard. It's hard reading. And I've heard a lot of people tell me, you know, or I shouldn't say tell me exactly, but like online, they'll say, oh, I love super training. And I'm thinking to myself, you're lying. You didn't read that whole book. And if you did,
that's why we're doing this, is to help people actually get and read through it.
Team Builder is Strength Coach Network's trusted provider for online software for strength coaches. It does not matter what sector of strength conditioning you work in, you want to get Team Builder because you will be able to program for your athletes, simply distribute the training to them, and make changes, modifications, whatever you need. I've been utilizing them since 2019 when I was back at Towson. I still use it in person at Goldfinch with all my remote clients throughout the country, and in person at the high school, Centennial High, right down the road when I was volunteering for them. You got to check out Team Builder in the link down below. The people that work for them are former strength and conditioning coaches, so they get it. They are able to help you with all of your needs. Again, reach out to your Team Builder rep and learn more about them in the link down below.
Because it is, like, we read it as a staff at the University of Maryland, and I read it again a little bit at Iowa, but you're right. Like, it's a book that you need to read every once in a while again, just to come back and establish it. Because like you said, we will say, you know, strength when it's really strength endurance that he talked about here.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
right.
And that's why we need to be very specific with the words that we use, so we can be very specific with the athletes and things that we're doing. Because like you said, absolute, competitive, and maximal, to anybody listening now, unless you're working in track and field, realistically, your competitive max is more like your 1RM, like your testing day, for lack of a better term. And then your training max is just going to be what you do every day in the weight room. And that's sometimes where you might see athletes have a hard time. And we used to see that happen all the time at Iowa. If somebody would hit, you know, a new PR, and then now their new 80% is what their old 87% used to be. And it's, you have to get to that same excitatory level, if that's even a word, to get that 80% for, you know, six reps.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I think that Yuri made a good point in there too, where he talked about, you know, look, most sports don't require that maximum lift ever anyway, right? The excitation that is involved, all that stuff. And also that the recovery time takes too long. So you couldn't be doing that in competition. It's impossible because you couldn't recover from it. Not in time to compete again, right? So I think that the other thing is, like you just mentioned, strength endurance. Like when you talk about the 1x20, as an example, and you know, athletes get much stronger. Does their one rep max get strong in commensurately? No, because you've got to kind of be up in that range of training. You go up to it and train at, then that max lift is going to go up, you know, a good amount. But you got to train in 90% plus for a while to get a good, you know, jump in the maximum, or if you want to call it training maximum, right? So I think that one of the things that also has to be talked about is, how did you develop the strength? You know what I mean? Like that amount. Because I think one may have more application in your sport than the other one will. You know, because you'll see a power lifter whose one rep maxes are incredible, but if you get them on the field, they can't display it very well. Exactly. You know what I mean? Like,
which is why that's where a lot of these people that don't want to lift their athletes heavy, right? I'm not going to name certain sports, but they're like, well, it's, you know, strength. And one of the terminologies, and I'm actually working on an article right now, is what is the definition of strength? And so this is great with this, because we defined it at Iowa as strength is maintaining posture under load. So that's where, yes, you're going to have strength endurance, maximal strength, absolute strength, but making sure that we're not forgetting that other part with it, whether it's strength endurance, you know, strength, speed, putting that other word and some emphasis on it, and making sure that you keep that and not just saying, oh, we're doing strength training, and you're really doing 12 repetitions at 70%.
Right, right. Exactly. So I think that you kind of have to keep that in mind and kind of be aware of that all the time, because otherwise it gets sloppy. As you said, you know, we could be talking about two different things. You know what I mean? You know, you say, well, my quarterback, he can squat, you know, 400 for one rep. That's totally different than me saying we've got somebody who can squat 350 for 14. Different things, right? Because he can display that strength over and over again, where the other guy can't. And the other thing is, if that's all he's been doing, the nervous system's been trained to be really slow, because that movement is so slow, if that makes sense.
Now, the question, coaches working in team sport, like you said, does, for them, they might be thinking, okay, well, you know, Yosef, Justin, does it really matter though, if all I have to do is try to get, you know, my athletes to do the work that they need to do?
Yeah, it matters. I mean, you know, it does matter. I mean, I can tell you, and I'm sure you've got much more experience with this than me. You've had a lot of guys on your teams, guys who are weight room warriors, and they're training like power lifters, and they are really strong. They are really strong people, right? And you see it on Instagram or other mediums where you see, you know, some of these programs of the guy super strong. And then you go back and look and realize, I don't even know who this guy is, because I don't see him play on Saturday. Am I right? Am I right? Like, he's the guy in the weight room, but he's not on the field. And so that is where there's a disconnect, right? Like, okay, it's nice that he does those things. I'm not, you know, making a big deal out of that. But it's like, look, you know, once again, we're here to get the job done for them to play better, not just to chase a number per se. Especially, and it's not just a number. Even if you're chasing a number, but on different numbers, like, I want to see how many times you can display that, you know, strength, right? Or over here, you know, you can only do it once. I don't know how valuable that is, right? So these max out days, like I see this with high school too. You know, I've seen a number of programs where they max out once a week, It's like, for what? Like, what, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, you're keeping track of numbers. You're being competitive. I understand that idea, but man, that's not the place to do that. Like to chase single, one rep numbers. It just doesn't make any sense.
You're right. And I think one of the things that I really like was on page 6 for any of our listeners. So where you talked about the modern era dawns where weightlifting and powerlifting was competitive performance against max resistance, bodybuilding for hypertrophy. But he broke it down where it's like, we need all of those. And how he said, the information is selected from the above sources to present an integrated approach. So he's not saying, when you're training athletes, you only do this. No, you have to steal and use what applies. Yeah. And that's where, he said coaches haven't read this book. And so they turn into, I'm an Olympic. Like, even this smart of a human being is saying, don't be only an Olympic lifting based strength coach when you work with athletes. That's not what they're doing.
Right. Exactly. And he says in there, when he talks about the supplementary resistance, it's to enhance fitness in other sports. Like you're trying to if the kid plays multiple sports, he's trying to improve his abilities in those particular sports. And that's the reason why, in strength and conditioning anyways, that was the original reason why the field started in the United States. I think, was it Boyd Epley?
Exactly.
Boyd Epley, I think, was the guy that started the association or whatever. That was the whole point. And now it's gone to, because they knew there was this very sloppy connection. We know that stronger athletes are better athletes. True. What they didn't say was up to a point.
Correct.
And how did we do it? How did the nervous system get developed during that time? Because you can make big, changes. And one thing that the late Anatoly Bondarchuk told me, he said, look, he goes, training at 90% or above, he said, should never, ever be in the calendar year of a lower level athlete, and only 10% of an elite athlete at the most. And you got to remember, he only trained Olympic level, guys, world class guys. And he said with athletes lower than that, he said it makes an imprint into the nervous system that can never be erased. So when you come back to it later, if they're an elite athlete, he said it really won't have the value anymore. So he said, you want to save it until you're forced to use it because everything else has kind of not worked as well. So you use, and even Yuri said that, like in the strength, the manual, he says, you use this when the nervous system has become rigid and they're not responding and you need something to kind of, move it and get things going again. But it should not be a centerpiece.
I think, can you redefine for our strength coaches what an actual, an advanced athlete is? Because I think that has gotten, again, so bastardized, especially in today's world where our listeners are working in team sports. Yes, there's some in the private setting, but their clients are team sport athletes where they're going to label an athlete elite because they're elite on the field, but they're not actually elite in the weight room, or do they have a high training
background? So in the United States, the term is used for people who are genetically gifted primarily. That's an elite athlete. So it'll be, somebody will say that, let's say you got a freshman that comes in and he's just a phenomenal, natural athlete. Let's say he's an elite athlete. He's not.
Hawken Dynamic is Strength Coach Network's trusted provider for force plates and for handheld dynamometers. Not only am I using it now in the private sector at Goldfinch, I was utilizing this software when I was back at Towson University. You're able to transport the plates because I've taken them from our private sector facility to our other locations. Also been able to take it from our private in-person location to the high school down the road to do some testing with athletes right then and there. You're able to pair your true strength with the Striking Difference machine. The people at Hawken are fantastic. The technology is second to none. You have to learn more about Hawken Dynamic in the link down below.
What they mean by, what the Russians meant by a high-level athlete was they had actually grades, like different stages of graduation, if you will, for the athlete. And so what they said was from 0 to 5 years minimum, you're a low level athlete. And that's how many years of training under the supervision of an expert coach. And most of our coaches are not experts.
I was ready to say
number one, right? So, and by the way, let me give a little other little piece of information. In order for you to work with the lower level athletes, even then, you had to have an education. You couldn't be like a PE teacher and work with them. You had to have a degree specifically, you know, in exercise science or whatever. It wasn't just a general degree. And a lot of times you had to have a graduate level degree to be able to work with kids. And it was under a very systematic approach that the government over there had developed. Then they say somewhere between 5 and 8 years, you'll see a transition to what you call an intermediate athlete. So this requires a little bit of a different approach. And then at bare minimum, it was about 8 years, 8 to 10 years, where you would see the transition into being called a high-level athlete. So you could be a high-level athlete and get beaten by somebody younger than you and not as advanced as you because they're more genetically gifted. So it's the years of trainedness under the supervision of an expert coach. That is the criteria for determining what level of athlete you are. It's not on ability or performance. It's on – because what you're really looking for is – what that tells you is if you tell me you have an intermediate athlete or you tell me that you have a high-level athlete, it's how plastic is their nervous system. Right? That tells me what can we do with them. And here's what happens in the United States is most guys know like this, a ton of different methods, right, that they've read about or heard about. And then they apply them to their high school athlete, which is, you know, grossly inappropriate. Yes. Right. And they're like, you know, we got to push these guys. We're going to, you know, lift them hard and whatever. When, you know, it's not required. And a light touch really is all that's needed, you know, with a lower level athlete. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to push them very hard to get the result that you want.
As Kier would say, it'd be like giving chemo for a headache.
Yeah. Jake did give me credit, but he quoted that all the time. Because when he first asked me, I said, you don't give chemotherapy for a cold, right? I think that's how it came down. Because Jay repeated that multiple times. He liked that. It's like if you have a baby who has an infection, they give a baby level of antibiotics. They don't give an adult level because you'll destroy all the bacteria and then they'll be more vulnerable to a sickness that is worse, right? Because you wipe everything out. Now you're really vulnerable to the next infection that comes along. And they found that out, you know, in the last 20 years that when they were giving out antibiotics in the 80s and 90s, like they were candy, they realized it was wrong. You know, it was a mistake because then you were having kids getting real ear infections they couldn't get over. You know, and they'd have to put tubes in their ears, you know. Or like if you had a cold, like now you go to the doctor with a cold, he doesn't even want to hear it. He's like, okay, well, you'll be fine. Back then they were given antibiotics for them. And it just doesn't make sense. You know, and you might get a short-term gain like you might get with medicine, that analogy. You might get a short-term benefit, but in the long term it's not a good idea. Right. Because now when you come back to it later, it's not going to be effective. If you overuse an antibiotic, it stops being effective. You overuse any kind of medication, it stops being effective. If you overuse a method or prematurely use a method in this field, it no longer becomes effective. And that's what Dr. Bondarchuk said. He said, if you do that, he goes, when they're older, it's not going to work or it's going to have a limited effect. You want to keep as many bullets in the chamber as possible.
Exactly. And that's even why strength coaches nowadays are finally starting to learn about letting their athletes not be recovered in the off season and to stop trying to always recover and use cold tub, cryotub, any of the things, because it's like, no, they need to actually be.
Let me give you something that is interesting. This was news to me at the time. It's been a while now, but you know, I had read a lot of stuff on recovery methods in the Soviet Union. And when I first got started, I thought, well, you're going to have to really, you know, use these really extensively because you're going to be training so hard, right? That was just kind of how I thought about it, I guess. And I remember talking to Natalia, I think her dad was still alive. And I said, what does your dad think about recovery methods? You know, like, what does he like? And she goes, he doesn't. And I was like, really? She goes, he likes the sauna. Now, here's what's funny. People think the sauna is a recovery tool, and it's not. It's an adaptogenic. The body has to adapt to the stress so it becomes more resilient to other stresses later. But it's not, it doesn't recover the body, it hardens it, right? If so, here's the point. If you have to use a lot of recovery tools, the training's too hard. You need to dial it back. So here's the rule of thumb. If you're training at 80%, you need around 72 hours to recover, right? Give or take. If you're still sore after 72 hours, you should change things. Because now you've thrown off that rhythm of work and recovery ratio, right? So if you're needing a recovery methods quite a bit, the problem isn't the recovery. The problem is you're too much. You've got too much volume or intensity or combination. You need to dial that back to where you can recover on pace, you know, after so many hours. Because then you can train again.
There's something on page six. There's something on page seven that I want to get to, because it gets me all hot and bothered when it comes to a lot of people talking about fascia training and like these weird different angles. And they claim that it's, you know, fascia training when we have right here at the beginning talking about the fundamental principle of strength training is that all strength increase is initiated by neuromuscular stimulation. And you've talked at length about the nervous system. And then while you go a little bit further down, all right, the four, you know, one, two, three, four, intramuscular coordination, so different muscle groups working together, inter, the coordination of the fibers within the same group, which has rate coding, frequency, pattern encoding, the facilitatory inhibitory reflexes, so making sure that you're not, agonists aren't turning on, and then motor learning. So you've got all of these things going on within the muscular system and the nervous system. Yet people arbitrarily want to say, oh, that's the fascia that got stronger, even though we know from this research that you can't make that claim.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that what happens is that, you know, people, there's always, what was that? I think it was a saying by P.T. Barnum. He said, there's always somebody willing to do something cheaper, easier, and quicker, and looks cooler. And he goes, and those people that go for it are his lawful prey. And I think that that is the same thing with some of these ideas, is that they get off on a tangential thing and trying to establish some new area. Here's the thing that you should know, I think, more than anything. There is nothing new under the sun. There's nothing new. And the Russians still, in my opinion, were, when they left off in 91, 92, whenever that was, they were 30 years ahead of where we're at right now.
Player Data is Strength Coach Network's trusted provider for GPS technology, and it's simple. The price you cannot beat, and the validity and accuracy of their technology is second to none. The price is outstanding. Go ahead and reach out to them to learn more about the pricing specific to you and however many units you're going to get. And then the validity. Player Data has been tested and run through FIFA's validation process for FIFA to then be utilizing Player Data technology. FIFA, we all know that name. They would not be utilizing a product that cannot live up to the competition and cannot be able to provide real, live, and accurate data. Player Data is able to do this. Not only do they have great software and hardware, but I know that the customer service is fantastic because I have worked with these individuals before. Click the link down below to learn more about Player Data.
Still way, 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 way ahead of us. So I think, like what you said, is that some of these things like the fascial training and all that stuff as a separate entity, I don't think holds water. It's part of it, but it's like it comes along for the ride. It doesn't have to be, it's not a separate thing, right? And I've heard that people say, you know, hey, different, we got to train this separately and that separately. The training encompasses, if the training's developed correctly, it's encompassing, right? So if you'd like, I'll give just a quick, couple quick thoughts on this. On the processes of inter and intramuscular coordination, this is a nervous system thing, and it's being learned at the very initial level, right? The muscles are getting, like, you don't even have to get, I don't want to say stronger, but like you don't even have to worry about how strong are they getting. As they're doing the movement, and I've had this happen, I'll have somebody, let's say, for example, let's say they're squatting, which is a little bit of a harder one. That's one of the harder exercises to teach in the very beginning. And you'll see them kind of like, oh, their knees are a little wobbly. You know, they're kind of having trouble holding the position. And I was just doing this last week, and I told the parent, I said, what you're seeing is they're developing inter and intramuscular coordination. The brain is giving feedback on how to do this. So we're not going to take the weight up. we're going to repeat the same weight for a while until, as we watch this get cleaned up, as they get more coordinated, right? And then, and that also ties in with the motor learning, right? That you see all these things kind of, they're convergent on each other. And then what's happening, you'll see this as we talk about this later on, I'm sure, like with like specialized exercises, you'll see that the inter and intramuscular coordination is a really, it's an important thing, because now you're actually developing the skill that's going to occur on the field or on the court. And those ideas there are, they're the core, I guess, if you will, around what all this is built around. If that makes any, I hope that makes sense.
No, it does. And the thing that I was reading here as we were talking about that was what he said on page 8 with the changes in neural training, where I'm trying to find the balance between it. And I want your thoughts on it, where, you know, saying here that small changes, right? Excuse me. This is, he says, this is one of the main reasons why text emphasizes the importance of planned variation using numerous different means, but in the same time, understanding that, subtle differences, apparently as insignificant in the change in grip, the stance or head position, can cause significant neural changes, which control the way which the athlete executes a given skill. So, hey, we've got to change things so they don't, you know, become, blunt to this, to the stimulus that we're trying to give them, but we can't change it too much because then they can't actually adapt to it. And then also thinking of things that like Louie and Westside was known for, from what I've heard, of changing your foot stance, changing your hand grip, within even, you know, set to set on a certain movement. But is that okay, because those were truly more advanced athletes because they had years under their belt?
I think that that with powerlifters, I think it's a different thing, because the sport is the lift. Right. Whereas when you're squat, like, for example, when you're squatting, and this is talked about, I think, in here, and it's talked about in other like, I know Bondarchuk talked about it a lot. What is that? If you're, let's say, for example, you're squatting, and the, and a lot of people who are powerlifters, they'll have their feet out, right? They have them turned out, and their stance will be, you know, wider than shoulder width. But when you're an athlete, you want the feet turned in straight ahead, because that's the way it's going to happen when they play, right? And you also want, you know, it not to be too much wider than shoulder width, because most actions in sports don't happen from shoulder width into hip width, give or take, right? There's not too many of them that are way out like that. And so the my point is that you make subtle changes. Like Dr. Yeses would always say, I remember when I first met him, I think I had been taught to squat and look up at the ceiling. They always said, just look up, right?
Same.
And and I remember when I met him, and he goes, and I did that, and he goes, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know. And he said, look straight ahead. Do you look up when you're playing? No. He said, well, all right then. He said, look straight ahead. Like, you know, I mean, he said, some of this stuff is just common sense. It ain't overly scientific. And I think that like what you just said, and like when they talk about hand grips, lifting belts, you know, wedges under the heels, things of this nature, and the suits and all that. Yeah, that's okay for like, if you're a power lifter, you know, because that's what you're actually going to do. Some of it may not make sense, but some of it could. But when you take that over into the area of developing athletes, it doesn't make sense. I don't think it makes sense. You don't want to, if you need a lifting belt, then your technique is poor. And you should work on that. Or maybe you're not as strong as you think you are. That could also be the case. But I definitely concur with that. Go ahead.
No, and then what I was going to say from that, based off of what you were talking about with the powerlifters and then the other athletes and maybe people who were getting to page 10 said, like, and they had it highlighted as well as I do, it's in italics. Sporting performance does not depend simply on the ability to produce maximum force. Since many sporting actions take place so rapidly, it's impossible to recruit an adequate number of muscle fibers. And I think coaches have taken that too far, where they won't do any heavy strength training because they'll say, well, see, it says it here that you don't have enough time, so we're never going to do it. But then they throw a baby out with the bathwater and they don't actually have the ability to get the benefits, the tendon health, the tapping into the type 2 muscle fibers that they get when they do that. So that's, again, where we're trying to help them walk this razor thin line of not going all one way or all the other.
I think this is where, from what I can tell, and you could speak to it better than I could, but from what I can tell from the outside looking in, is that there's not a lot of interaction of methods with these guys. Like, a lot of times that what they do is what they do all year round, if that makes sense. This is what I hear. Now, you know, you would know better than me. You could speak to it better than I could. But like, if they're a guy who's more powerlifting centric, they just use a bunch of different variation methods for powerlifting, kind of like maybe what Louis would do. Maybe Louis would use like chains for a while. Then he might use bands for a while. But there's no periodization, if you will. You know what I mean? Where you're looking at one thing, now we're looking at something different. And if you look in block periodization from Isserin, you know, he talks about, you know, you develop this first, then this. And in a lot of these situations, they don't do that. So that means, like, when you are lifting heavier at a time, that doesn't mean it's the whole calendar year. It's part of the year. And you're not training it for the effect it has on the field. You're training it for the effect that it has on the next thing that you're going to do. Does that make sense? Like that strength training is having an effect on other stuff. And so, like, even when we talked plyos earlier, does that strength training have an effect on the plyos? Yes, it does.
Vitruve is the trusted VBT source for Strength Coach Network, and I have been utilizing this for years at Goldfinch, and I'm going to continue to utilize it because the great price for the encoder, as well as the accuracy with the data. Whether I'm measuring average, peak, or any other metric, if I want to include range of motion, fatigue loss during the set, intra set, whatever it is, I can trust Vitruve, and they are continuing to push the needle and continuing to educate coaches on best practices within the VBT world. Not only do they live in that VBT world, but now they've come out with their new hub. And if you want to learn more about the hub and how it can help you with all of your athletes that you are working with, as we are starting to do this at Goldfinch for our middle school all the way up to college athletes, check them out in the link down below.
And then do the plyos have an effect back onto the strength training? Yes. They affect each other. And that's what you're looking at. And in transfer of training too, I think it is, Bondarchuk talks about that. He says there's tie-ins from one exercise to the other, the combinations of exercises and the way that you train them and how they affect each other. So you're right. You don't want to take that one principle and run with it. This is the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Wisdom is knowing the difference, you know, like how to apply the knowledge. The knowledge part is just you can regurgitate a bunch of stuff and say that you're doing it, and then it sounds cool. Does that make sense? Because I have strength coaches call me and they'll tell me what they read. Now, hey, we're doing this. And I'm like, well, okay, explain it to me. And then I realize they're doing, you know, they've got it all kind of screwed up.
Well, do you think that they don't take into all the factors? Like, do they not take enough of those factors into a part on page 12, specifically the training history, the injury history, the level of sports proficiency, like, all those factors taken into consideration, where you, me, Kier, Jay, other people that we, you know, Dom, that are doing it right. Yeah. But like, people that don't take that into consideration because they just think like, oh, this athlete either does or doesn't have that dog.
Yeah. I think, yes, I agree 100%. I think the biggest mistake, this is my opinion, especially starting at the collegiate level. No, I'm sorry. Starting at the high school level. Everybody assume. Here's the thing. Let me give a preface for all of this. None of the greats wrote any books for the level of athlete that you work with.
Ooh.
Never. Bondarchuk, Vereshchansky, Isserin, all the other greats did not write books for your level of athlete. These are only for elite athletes. Now, the principles, have application in a general sense, but they did not write for the level of athlete that you work with, right? This is one of the biggest misunderstandings in the United States, I think. So when I said knowledge and wisdom, knowledge is getting what you get from the book, and then wisdom is how do you apply it to your situation, okay? So when you take somebody in, everybody assumes they have an athlete that's high level or can be exposed to high level, right? And they can't. And so now you got a problem right out of the chute. You know what I mean? So you're looking at what you should be looking at is how plastic is this athlete's nervous system? And then what would be optimal for me to apply to that nervous system to get the optimal result, not only now, but 5 years from now? Because you can't go back and do things over, right? If you've laid this foundation, you've had somebody for 3 years and you've been training them way too intensely, what are we going to do in 5 years? How intense can it get? Mm. You know, does that make sense? So here's another example that I think is interesting. And when he talks about the shock method, he talks about the depth jump going up to 44 inches. Normally, you're only going to use one, maybe cross over to two heights in a whole training year, right? So if you start at 12 inches, that's 32 inches, right? That's 32-inch difference between 12 and 44. How many years is that going to take? A long time. It depends, but it's a long time, right? It could be, it's the whole athlete's career. Like, if he starts when he's, like, in middle school, you're talking until he's almost 30 before you would do that. And then once you get to that level, then he articulates super methods that he uses with the 44-inch depth jump and squatting and things of this nature. So my point is that you've got to look at, who do you got? Are you going to bring the guy in and start using a 44-inch depth jump and he's 16? You crazy? Right? It doesn't make... And if you read it without wisdom, you would do that. When people look at his coach's manual where he actually gives programs, none of those programs are designed for the athlete you work with. Because
But everybody applies it.
Exactly. This is my point. And so, like, you're in the field and you know way more strength coaches than I do. How many people that you know, period, are working with an athlete who's high level?
Not as many as wanted as they.
I would dare say it's minimal. You know what I mean? Like, there's not very many. It's minimal. So, you know, the point is that application wisdom here is probably the biggest thing. And I think the biggest difference for me in learning this stuff was having, I was blessed to have a great mentor who could knock down all my stupid ideas or my misunderstandings of what I was reading, right? I could start. It hit.
Which is what we're able to hear do for so many
coaches. Yeah. Because I remember I had been doing this for a while. And I remember asking Doc, I'd just gotten into the publishing business. And I said, so are you telling me that these guys only wrote for high-level athletes? They never wrote for low-level athletes? He goes, yeah. And that was like the light bulb when I'm like, wait, what? So none of this applies to the athletes that we're working with? No. I was like, you got to be kidding me. I thought, you know, it sounded cool, it looked cool. You know, I'm doing all, you know, whatever. Thinking I'm doing it. I wasn't doing it. But, you know, it was, once you realize who you're working with, and that the challenge is not the method. The challenge really isn't the effort that you get from the kid so much. The challenge is, how do I conserve all of the methods that I know? How do I economize them? How do I get the most bang for my buck each cycle without harming my potential in the next cycle? And then the next cycle. What I want to do is, when I have an athlete that comes to me at 14, I want to be able to tell him, for the next 16 years, I'm going to get you better every year. That's the challenge.
Correct. Anybody can get anybody sore. It's not hard to make an athlete sore in a training.
Can get somebody better. You can use, I don't want to say gimmicks, but you can kind of gimmick people up a little bit and get a good result for a while. But talk to me next year, because I'd like to see what you're doing then. That's going to, you know, be able to do that. Like, if you went out and started using a really high box, like, you know, high box for a depth jump and you get a result, what are we doing next year? If that makes sense.
Well, that, and so Mike Wadango, when he was on the show, he said that before too, where it's like, hey, we rush to when an athlete sets a new PR, that that's the new thing where it hasn't actually been actualized. So like how long, you know, with respect to the different training age of the athlete, how long is long enough where, okay, let's say Yosef, I'm working with you and I hit a new PR of a 500-pound max squat and my old max was 475. Yeah. And I went up 25 pounds this one day because I was all gassed up. How many times would you want to see me be able to hit that in training before we're like, no, that's like actually your competition or your training max, getting back to some of our terms at the beginning of the talk.
How many times would I want to see the athlete do it? That's an interesting question because I don't ever really.
Yeah, before you're able to be like, you know what, this is pretty normal for them, or even with respect to like sprinting speed.
Yeah, I would say I don't ever keep track of training maxes. I look at the maxes that they may have at around 80%, like what's the most that they've done, right? And it's stable because it keeps kind of gradually progressing. So I don't know.
Powerlift is Strength Coach Network's trusted provider for exercise equipment. Made here in the USA, right down the road in the state of Iowa, Powerlift has the ability to customize whatever you need in your room, regardless of the sector of strength conditioning. If you need a massive, big room, they have the ability to help you with that. If you're confined with space and you need to get creative, their reps are able to help you get what you need done and being able to get any customizations that you or your organization want with your logo on the equipment. Click the link down below to learn more about Powerlift. And if you have any questions about them, please feel free to reach out to us.
I don't even look at maxes, to be honest with you. I don't even think about it. Because to me, it doesn't matter. If that makes any, does that make sense? I don't know if I answered that question very well. I'm not sure if I'm understanding it totally.
No, I mean, because that'll just show coaches right there why they don't need to get too hung up on, you know, just a one RM for their athletes. Like, yes, track it so you can track athlete progress, but don't put your entire life savings in your self-worth as a coach.
Oh, okay. Let me give another small explanation then, just so that makes more sense. So like with Anatoly, he said, you always want to have a test exercise, right? So for him, it was kind of easy because they threw every day. So he would just check the throw. But he said, you know, have a test exercise. In our terminology, people call it a KPI or whatever. What I'm normally looking at, as long as the strength levels on whatever percentage we're working in, whether it be 60, 70, or 80, I'm looking for, you know, nice, smooth, you know, we're getting some improvement. And I don't need a ton. I get a ton, but I'm not losing sleep over it, to be honest with you. So let me preface. I do have kids that I work with that are really strong. But I wasn't shooting for it. I just let it do what it does. I turned it on and it ran its course. Here's what I'm looking for, though. I'm looking at, you and I were just talking about the golfer that I work with. She now has a simulator, so we can check it regularly. And I said, and I just told her this the other day. I said, about every 2 weeks, tell me how far you're hitting. And then I have another softball player. They put the checker exit velocity. Every couple of weeks, tell me where the exit velocity is, right? Because now we're talking about the thing that she actually does, right? So if it's a runner, what you're looking for, let's say, you know, somebody who's sprinting, we may not be sprinting yet. Say, like, we might be at the time of year where they're running 400s maybe, because we use what you would call a long to short method. We start way back, you know, with the 20, when we're using the 20 rep stuff, we're normally running a mile. Give or take, for to develop the condition. And I'm talking ball sports for the most part is where we do that at. But I'm looking at, is that getting better workout to workout? Number one, what if we're running, whatever distance we're running, is that getting slightly better every workout? Good. Okay, that's a KPI. Then the second one is I look at the jumps that we use that I can measure. So normally the horizontal jump that I use is one I can measure easily because I can just tell the athletes measure. You know, how far out are you jumping, measure it up against the wall, mark it off. And what we know is we use that jump until it stops improving. And then when it stops improving, we dovetail out into another jump that might be progressively, you know, more, maybe a little more difficult. If that makes sense. That's how I determine that you're becoming. So I know in this general sense, I can't speak to every detail, but I know that in a general sense, you're becoming a better athlete. And then once I
That's where I would just say right here, like, let the sport be the KPI.
Yeah, I think the sport's the KPI. And I know that, like, in football, you know, they're not going to go out and play, right? But if you're looking for the athlete to be faster, if they're running all year round, I think one of the things that these guys do, this is from what I've observed anyway, they only run shorter distances and they run the same distances all year round, or you know what I mean? And it's a little bit harder to get adaptation that whole time, right? Yeah. So what I do is I run the distance normally. I'll run the distance until they don't improve anymore. Then we'll switch to a different distance, a shorter distance. We'll run that till they stop improving. Now, when they're younger, we may not even get down to the shorter distances because they're still improving on the longer ones. But here's the reality. Those longer distances, if they're improving there, they're improving on the shorter ones too. You know, once they get into that season, if you will. But the point is the Russians, when they looked at everything, when they developed a method, the reason why they developed it was because the previous method stopped working. So you make changes when what you were doing stops working, right? So the athletes will ask me, they're like, how long am I running this till you stop getting faster at it? And then we change. And then how long are we going to do the 20s? Sometimes until it stops working. You know, if the kid's 12, it's going to, no matter what, he's going to do 20s. But like, let's say he's 16 and he could do something heavier, but he's still getting better. Why would I change if he's still getting better? Because it's not going to get better faster.
Boredom.
It's not going to get better faster with higher intensity. It's only going to get better less fast with higher intensity. Because the body will adapt more quickly and faster when the load is lighter, or, you know, because then the body can adapt real quickly. It doesn't have to dig deeper into different reserves. It's easier, right? It's more seamless. And this is why you see, like, a little kid, you know, when you're teaching them something, they learn super quick. You know, they get better at something. Their motor ability. Why is that? Because the intensity is really low. One, I mean, it's not the only reason. I don't want to say that, because they're very plastic. But you're not giving them something really intense. You're just, hey, this is, you know, showing them something nice and easy, and they pick it right up. If you go in and make it intense, it doesn't work as well. If you were to teach a kid, I can't think of a skill right now, but any kind of a skill, and you make it more intense and harder, their learning curve will, you know, come down as opposed to go up.
Dasher is Strength Coach Network's trusted provider for timing gates for your athletes. Whether you're trying to run A-cells, curve, flies, change in direction with the Pro Agility, the 505, modified 505, whatever you want to do, get valid and reliable setup with your Dasher. I had the black, the blue, and now we have the silver at Goldfinch. We're completely moving over from the blues to just only having the silvers. I only test my athletes on the silvers because it has helped me save so much time, whether I'm going from Ankeny over to Nevada or Ankeny over to Huxley, whatever I got to do. I save so much time, and I want you to be able to save so much time with your setup, because we know that time is precious as strength coaches. Now, not only are you going to be able to save time, but you're going to be able to save money with this great product, and you have a valid and reliable product that has run through countless different articles, as you continue to see online being published with the accuracy of this information. So, if you want to learn more about Dasher, click the link down below to be able to go to their website and learn more about them.
If it's nice and light, they'll learn much more quickly.
Goes back to the nervous system, which ties it all back in. And folks, this was literally just the first 15 pages of this book. We could talk about this forever, but that's why we're going to come back next week and be able to keep explaining this to you. Like, we'll be diving into pages 15 through 30. So keep on reading. Yosef, is there anything that you want to end with as the expert, anything that you want to end with for anybody here that you feel like, hey, We drove home that point of the nervous system and the differences in the novice and your expert and your intermediate athletes. Is there anything that you want to put a bow on?
Yeah, couple short things. One is, if there's questions, you can email them to me or send them to me on social media and about the book, and I'll be happy to address it when we do this. You know, like if there's something specific that we didn't talk about. Secondly, I didn't talk to you about this ahead of time, Justin, but for the people who are listening, we're going to sell Super Training on our site for $55, which I think is about $25 less than anywhere else you'll see it. So they go to my site, they get a discount. Yeah, because I don't think it's being sold any less than $75 anywhere. through all our resellers. So if you want the book, you go on our site. The normal shipping applies. You get it for $55. So it's a little bit of a deal and maybe makes more of an incentive to follow along. So those two things, questions, get the book, you know, at a discount if it's something that you'd like to have. And the key is always remember that you're learning knowledge, but then you also need guidance on the wisdom of how to apply something. Because you and I could read a book on brain surgery, right? Should we go operate on anybody? You know what I mean?
Nope.
Same idea. I've said this many times before, but I think it bears repeating here. What we're doing is just as complicated scientifically as brain surgery. The difference is if me and you are wrong, people don't die. But it's just as complicated. It's not as easy as everybody thinks. So you can read it, think you understand it, and then you realize later that you didn't understand it, not well enough to where you could apply it effectively. So always bear in mind that when you're reading something, especially high-level stuff like this, it's not as simple as it may look to you initially. It's not like a manual of, okay, take this and then just go put it into action. It's not that simple. There's a lot of nuance, and there's a great deal of wisdom that's necessary in learning in that way for you to be able to apply it effectively.
It's a perfect place to wrap it up. We will see you all here back next week.